Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 22, delivered on November 10, 2016. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Tonight, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. This is somewhat like the culmination of the course. There's one chapter after this that we cover after the exam next week. But this is kind of like the ultimate. Now, as I had told you before, beta is the non-diversifiable risk of a security or a portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Beta is the non-diversifiable risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. If I were to ask you on an exam, what is beta? Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. You would answer that and nothing else, and you would get all of the credit. But you've got to remember to make sure that you say that it's the non-diversifiable risk, and it is relative to the market portfolio. So, madam, how tall are you relative to yourself? Wait, you're 5'6"? Oh, wait, no, get back on track. relative to, you would say I'm 100% of my own height. I mean, that was kind of a trifling question. That's probably why you're trying to find it something a little bit deeper in there. No. Relative to yourself, how much do you weigh relative to yourself? Exactly. So how much risk does the market portfolio have relative to the market portfolio? So in other words, the beta of the market portfolio is exactly 1.00, okay? Now let's try this one. I'll give you a chance to redeem yourself, madam. If you're dead, how much do you twitch? Zero, yeah, okay. You're like, well, I need to leave here. Listen, okay. If you are the most boring guy in the universe, how exciting are you?
Not a lot.
Nothing, zero, nada. You got nothing, okay? Anyway, so in other words, the beta of a risk-free instrument would be zero. So in other words, I could write two theoretical points on a capital market line. If the points are beta versus the return, I know that with a beta of 1.00, I get a return that is the expected return to the market portfolio. And if I have a beta of 0.00, I will get the risk-free rate of return. So I have two points on a line. Well, what would that line be? Well, if I were to plot beta of a security or portfolio, against its expected return. I know that one point would be at a beta of zero, and the risk-free rate. I know that. One point would be zero, comma, risk-free. I know that another point at exactly one would be one, comma, the expected return to the market portfolio. I know those two points. Essentially, they are the duh points. But if you remember from your dark algebra past, if you know two points on a line, you know the equation of the line. You can compute it. Now, I don't want to go into too much of the algebra of it, but you remember that two-point form of a line. You've got y minus y1 equals m times x minus x1, and the m is the difference of two y coordinates over the difference of the associated x coordinates. That thing that you never want to use, but we do use it sometimes. But I mean, one way or the other, if I know two points on a line, I know the equation of the line. If I know two theoretical points on the capital market line, I know the entire capital market line's equation. And hence, if I were to use, in other words, I know, see these two points? I know these two points right here. And by the way, the book uses somewhat fancier notation. It doesn't just write a case of M. It writes an E, open parentheses, R sub M. In other words, it kind of makes it a little bit fancier looking, but it's the same thing. This is the expected return of the market portfolio, case of M. This is the risk-free rate, case of F. Okay, and it's the same notation, but my notation is a little more compact because if you get too much notation, it kind of takes away the elegance and the underlying simplicity of something. But if I were to gyrate around and use the two points, one comma case of M, zero comma case of F, I would actually come up with, after some gyrations and all that kind of stuff, I would come up with this equation right here. The expected return to any security, case of S, the dependent variable, the expected return to a security or portfolio, that number that I've used in the past, pulling it out of thin air to find the discounts, the discount cash flows, find net present values, all that kind of stuff. This is the animal, this case of S. It is actually the way we find it in the real world is by case of S will equal case of F times the beta of a security, of that security or portfolio, times case of M minus case of F as a quantity. That right there, as long as I know the case of M and I know the case of F and the beta, I can find the discount rate to apply to cash flows. That is the quite famous capital asset pricing model, CAPM. If you are thinking of getting a tattoo, you can't go wrong with that one. Now, I make the joke about the tats because there was actually a kid when I was in grad school in the PhD program. He was so excited about financial economics, he got the CAPM tattooed on his left shoulder. Okay, on back here. We didn't know whether to pity him or beat him. He went back later and he got himself, because he was so much into economics, he got a graph of the supply and demand curves with the equilibrium marked out. Who does that? And he showed it to us. You know, he was so proud of it. And I just said, you don't have a girl, do you?
I will someday, man.
No, you won't. No. Turned out the guy actually got a job after his PhD with the Fed. He rose through the ranks. After 5 years, he went to work for one of the big banks in New York. He's making millions of dollars now, son of a bitch. So, anyway, just goes to show you. Anyway, that's the cap M. You give me a case of F. Now again, remember, I mentioned before, remember that this is the expected market premium over risk-free. Just to explain what is going on in this very simple formula. It's saying, okay, first of all, every security, you should get at least the risk-free rate. If you're getting less than the risk-free rate, you are a lame person. Because you can just put your money into treasuries and you can get the risk-free rate. So that's sort of like a rock base under all returns. And then it's saying, all right, here's your extra reward for taking the risk of the market, leveraged by how risky the security is. So in other words, the expected market premium over risk-free is sort of like your extra gravy for taking the market portfolio. But then whatever your stock is that you're investing in, that's going to leverage it up, the market premium, if it's a risky stock, or leverage it down below the portfolio if it's a less risky stock. Now, one thing I will point out to you is that if you are undergrad in finance, you would see the cap M is everything, and in the real world, it's everything. However, there are competing models for the return to a security. The way it works in academia is that you keep your job and you get these nice pay increases and you get advanced in what the name for the title you have by how many papers you publish. So one of the things you always want to do is find some way to make something old look obsolete and you've got a great better idea. So over the years, over the decades, CAPM has been assaulted, attacked, revised, by new methods, new equations. Honest to God, almost nothing can beat CAPM. Still stands as the gold standard. There's another one called the arbitrage pricing theory, APT. But I mean, no one uses it. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's just too complicated. CAPM is simple and elegant, and it works beautifully. It's fine. And if you go, if you're in finance, you'll see the CAPM is always what we use. You go into an MBA program, they'll probably have you do a basic finance course again. CAPM is what they're going to show you there too. Even in the PhD program, unless you're into derivatives and the really new age stuff that I do, CAPM, I even use CAPM. I mean, I wouldn't use this crazy stuff, derivative option pricing model stuff, for basic calculation of a discount rate to apply to cash flows. CAPM does it. That's how we find discount rates for cash flows. We just find the beta, and then we use a case of M and the case of F. Now, real quick here. The expected return to the market portfolio, case of M. The expected return, and remember, this is the expected return looking forward. So it's not the historical performance. It's what we see going forward. Like, for example, the stock market has done very well in recent years. Since the Great Crash, we came out of that. And the market performance historically for the last 5-7 years has been darn good. Huh? Oh, it sucked. Huh? Yeah, dude, it went down 600 points, and then it came back, and it's just a modest increase. It's not anything huge. Certainly not, and I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. That's very important to talk about. However, looking forward, we see that the expected return is probably going to be quite a bit less than what it has been over the last 7 years. And there's a reason for that, but we'll talk about that. I got to get into the politics of things and why you avoid the politics of things in doing your analysis. Okay, now, different services provide estimates of the case of M. the expected return of the market portfolio. They poll financial professionals and say, what do you think it is? What do you think it is? And they take a whole bunch of these estimates by different professionals, and they take an average of them. I am in one of those polls that is used by one of the services. There are a number of them, and they all are pretty close to each other. Once you get enough professionals asking, enough professionals, their individual quirks will get rid of each other, and you'll get more or less about the same. Right now, real world, right now, here's the number that is pretty much, and interestingly enough, right about where I said it was. I mean, 3 months ago, I would have called that same case of them about, a percent and a half higher. But now I'm calling it lower, as are most of the pros. Okay? And we'll talk about why that is. Now, the other one, the case of F. This is the risk-free rate. This is just pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption plus an expected inflation premium. Now, here's where it gets a little bit odd, and I have to make an admission here. Now, I've been doing this for decades, and the risk-free rate, we always, back in the day, we estimated that by the return on a very short-term Treasury security, the risk-free rate. In other words, well, what's the risk-free rate? Well, it's a theoretical, but we use a proxy of like the annualized yield on a three-month T-bill. Or maybe you just use the yield on a one-year T-bill. That's what you use for case of F. Now, it was about 5 years ago. I was just having a fit because the risk-free rate that I was seeing used in real-world calculations was not the one I was seeing in the charts, in the tables that were being reported by the Wall Street Journal. I couldn't figure out what the hell they were doing and where this case of F they were using was coming from. And much to my chagrin, I was bitching about it over coffee and donuts with a couple of other finance pros in New York City, and they said, well, duh. You don't use the three-month or the one-year T-bill, you moron. You use the 10-year T-bill, Treasury note or Treasury bill. And I said, what? He said, oh, yeah. We've been doing that for years. Where have you been? I said, why would you be using something that was so long? Yeah, it's a government security, so it's not going to default. But when you get that long, you've got a maturity premium in there. You remember that risk premium is a default premium plus a maturity premium plus a liquidity premium. Even treasuries have a little bit of maturity premium when you get long ones. Why are you using this? Where did this come from? And they said, oh, well, think about it. If you're using the CAPM to get discount rates for cash flows, how many projects are you really going to take on that are going to be 3 months or a year? Oh. They said, most of your projects are going to be, like 7, 10, 20-year projects. Why would you be using a short-term risk-free rate for what are not short-term cash flow profiles? And once they put it that way, these two guys, they were kind of making fun of the geezer who was back behind the curve, the knowledge curve. Oh, okay. Well, I guess I do get it. So what I would do here is now I would say, all right, I'm going to look at the 10-year Treasury yield. The 10-year Treasury yield. So, and this is, by the way, a very new one. This one is just today's. So in other words, again, back in the old days, I would probably pull the 0.72 or maybe the 0.48. But the best practices now is to go after the 7 or the 10. And I guess it's 10 is like very popular to use these days. So in other words, right now, the case of F is standing at about 2.15%. Okay? So now we have the practical stuff to use. So in other words, the expected return to the market portfolio over risk-free right now would be 9.20% less 2.15%, which would be 7.05% as of tonight. 7.05%. So that's your extra for the taking the risk of the market portfolio. So now we can start to use the CAPM in real life. Let me go over here, just pull one out of the finance.yahoo.com. And what am I thinking here? Let me try Netflix, NFLX. Its beta is about 0.8, I think, something like that. Yeah, 0.8. So Netflix, it's non-diversifiable risk. The risk that it would contribute to a portfolio would be less than the market. It's about 80% of the market's risk in a well-diversified portfolio. So now I can say, all right, what's the discount rate that I would apply to Netflix cash flows, to their projects, to the dividends? What discount rate would I apply? Well, here we go. It would be K sub F, 2.15% plus 0.80 times the expected market premium over risk-free, 7.05%. And by the way, you can use percentages here. Normally in math, you'd want to use the decimals, but since it's all percentages, just make sure your beta is a decimal. And if I work that out real quick here, just pounded out that number, which I should have brought up my calculator to start this. Okay, so I would do 2.15 plus beta 0.8 times open parenthesis 7.05, close the parenthesis, equals 7.79%. Now, if you've been in my class, you know that I've been pulling this out of thin air. That's, you know, for, well, we'll discount our cash flows for this project at, that's where we get it. That's, now you've seen the complete, we've completed the circle of the course in that regard. There it is, right there. The 7.79% would be what I would use for discounting the dividends to figure out a price, maybe. Or if I had Netflix had a new project and it was about the same risk as the company itself, I'd use 7.79% for deciding whether or not this was a go or a no-go as an NPV. That's how you do it, right there. And you can do that for any, I mean, and as I had brought this up before, is for projects, it's a little dodgy to do it, but, I mean, what are you going to do? If you got some company that's got a new project, what beta do you use for the project? Well, some companies would use the beta of the company itself. Okay, I've got a company, our beta is 1.15, so we'll use a beta of 1.15 to figure out what discount rate to apply for the project's cash flows to decide whether it's a go or a no-go by NPV. Other analysts will say, all right, let's find a small company that does only this kind of project, and let's see what its beta is and get a discount rate for the cash flows from that beta applied to the CAPM. There are things that I would get into in a heavier course with you, a little bit more complicated course. It gets kind of interesting whether you would use, okay, real quick. If I've got a project in a company, I would like to obviously get a discount rate to apply to the cash flows so I can find out the net present value, is it positive or negative, go or no go. Now I could, if I were to go out and say, all right, let's find a little company that does projects only like this one and apply this beta and find the discount rate by CAPM, I might not be doing it very well, because if my company is bigger and is more diversified, it might be the case that the risk of the project in my company is less than it is in a company that does only this project. I'd have more resources and all that. It's kind of hard to call. But I don't want to get into that too much, and I wouldn't ask you this on a test, that getting that deep on it. But I do want to show you something interesting. Always, always remember that everything we're doing here has to do with portfolios and securities in diversified portfolio environments. This does not apply to naked stocks at all, to projects just hanging naked out there in midair. And one of the best places to show this would be right here. And you can find these resources. I just pulled this one up because the book does a really nice one. Look at how much risk an individual stock has on its own that you will not get rewarded for. You can't expect a reward. See this profile for Boston Beer and for Microsoft. Boston Beer, most of the risk of that stock is risk that you cannot expect a reward for bearing, because you could get rid of that risk in a well-diversified portfolio. Now, if you're a thrill seeker, go for it. But don't expect the market to pat you on the back for taking this kind of risk. Even Microsoft, look at Microsoft, a monstrous company. But easily about 40% of its volatility, 40% of its risk is risk that you are not going to expect a reward for, because it would go away in a well-diversified portfolio. So I can't emphasize this enough. Those betas measure only this part of the risk that you should expect reward for bearing. In hanging on their own, out there, naked, stocks, assets, projects, they are risky as hell. Okay, and now, having pointed that out, I do want to come back here full circle. Notice the capital market line. This shows expected returns against betas. And it's always in motion. But there's some things that you can see about it. First of all, if the Fed starts pushing up interest rates, but the expected return to the market portfolio stays about the same, have a blue mark. Okay, again, if the Fed starts pushing up interest rates, looky there, if you look at the risk-free rate, you notice that it is tracking upward. Do you see it? Okay. Now, if we say, okay, the economy is fundamentally strong and the market portfolio is going to stay on track, it's not going to change the expected return to it. In a case like that, we would go from a risk-free rate here to a risk-free rate higher, case of F2. But we would stay on the same point at beta equals 1. Then, this is what the capital market line would do. Notice that for high beta stocks that would originally have expected return, like look at this beta right here, about 1.3. It originally has an expected return up here, okay? But notice that as the capital market line is pivoting downward, this security is going to go from an expected return here to an expected return that is lower. But notice what happens to securities that have betas less than 1. Do you see it? Talk to me. Do you see what happens with securities that have betas less than 1? What's happening to a security that had a beta that was 0.5? See how its expected return was there, and now it's there? Defensive stocks, stocks that have low betas, would actually show improved expected returns in this particular scenario, where the short-term treasury instruments yields are going up, but the market portfolio's expected return is staying the same. Aggressive securities and portfolios would tend to have their expected returns go down. You see that? See how the expected return on the original line was up here? The expected return on the new line is down there. But defensive stocks, stocks with low betas, would tend to show improved expected returns. That's the first scenario. And that essentially what that means is simply that in an environment where short-term rates are doing good, you're going to get leverage on things that rely for most of their return on the risk-free rate. Do you see how when beta is small, most of your return is coming from the risk-free rate? So if the risk-free rate is going up, then this equation, because there's more load on the case of F, your expected return to the security does better. Okay. Now, let me go to another scenario, one that is more like what we're having right now. Suppose that both the risk-free rate rises, but the expected return to the market portfolio falls. So that was the original market expected return to the market portfolio. Now here's the new return to the market portfolio. So in other words, the line is actually pivoting, flattening, but it's also sinking. In a situation like that, what would be your best investment strategy? In an environment where the Fed is pushing short-term treasury bill rates up, and the market is beginning to show weakness, fundamental structural weakness, so the market portfolio's expected return is beginning to slide. Do you see a way out of the first level of hell in a situation like that? What would you do as an investor? Look at the new capital market line. Is everything going to hell or not? What would you do in a portfolio situation? You got any idea? You see it? Okay. Do you see it? Is anything doing better in this situation? Very low betas. Look. Look here. You see how all of these returns up here are going downward from the black to the blue? All of these are going downward. But there are still stocks that are highly defensive that are actually improving. Just like in the original scenario, except that you've got to go much more defensive to get the benefit. You've got to get as far away from aggressive securities. You're not going to go just below beta of 1. You're going to have to go in even more, going it down to betas below 0.5 maybe. That's the only way, but it is a way in an environment where short-term treasury rates are rising and the expected return to the market portfolio is falling. You just have to get very defensive in your portfolio construction. You have to just basically pull in your horns here. Now, a word about politics in all of this. The markets in late overnight, after the election returns, became pretty clear what was going to happen. Futures markets around the world started collapsing. I mean, we're talking about the circuit breakers. In other words, governments shutting down stock market activity to keep the essentially keep the zombie apocalypse from happening. Well, eventually, once the markets got themselves put back together again, the stocks began to come back into normal profile. Now, real quick here, the Let me expand this so I can actually see it. Notice that the Dow did a darn good job today. The Standard & Poor's 500, that's kind of a wash. It's a little positive, but it's pretty much a wash. In other words, once the market got its initial shockwave out of it, then it put itself back into a configuration, and it's going to play a wait-and-see kind of game. It's still going to be moving upward, but it's going to play very close to the chest. And the reason is this. It has nothing to do with the politician himself or herself. It has to do with the risk of the situation. When you know a commodity, when the commodity that is, the political commodity is known, that's low risk. Low risk generally tends to mean a higher price. A high risk tends to mean a lower price. That's just basic financial economics. Higher risk will tend to cause prices to suppress. All right, I am giving you the chance, sir, to buy a very new kind of cheeseburger made with a kind of cheese that has been used in other parts of the world, but it's never been heard of here. You don't know anything about it. The burger that is being used comes from the special kind of cow, from a place that you've never heard of before. Okay, now are you going to pay a lot of money for that, or are you going to say, I'd better get a discount before I'm going to try something like that? You'll probably want a discount. You're not going to be stupid. Yeah, I'm going to pay $5 million for a burger like that. No, you don't know what's in it. And that is what happens when you have anything new in the political arena. It's going to cause an initial shockwave of risk aversion. Stocks are going to pull back, and then they're going to look to see what's going to happen next. So right now, you've had the initial shock, and now the markets are going to sit back and say, let's wait and see. So the bottom line is, though, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, a leftist or a right-winger, don't let your political feelings, well, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, I'm going to buy. That's stupid analysis. Be objective. You can have your own bias. You know, personally, our new president, I wouldn't trust my kids or my cats around him, especially my cats with what he grabs. But I didn't say that. God. Anyway. But that does not mean that your political leanings, one way or the other. We had one candidate who was a Wall Street insider, a shill for Wall Street, connected up and down the food chain with the banking industry, the stock markets, and all that. That one's out of the picture now. We've got an unknown quantity in there that causes a degree of uncertainty. Uncertainty is risk. More risk means lower prices. But also keep in mind that lower risk can mean higher expected return. We don't know if that's how this is going to play out because it's always the expected return that matters. But for the time being, hold your portfolio the way it is and keep your doors locked and your cats inside. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.